This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
It's from the Blue Cliff Record, case 6, main case. Master Yumen said, I don't ask you about before the 15th day. Try to say something about after the 15th day. And then he himself answered for everyone. Every day is a good day. The verse. He throws away one and picks up seven. Above, below, and in the four directions, there's no comparison. Placidly walking along, he treads down the sound of the flowing stream. His relaxed gaze descries the tracks of flying birds. The grasses grow thick, the mists overhang. Round Subhuti's cliff, the flowers make a mess. I snap my fingers. How lamentable is Shunyata. Don't make a move. If you move, 30 strikes. Master Yunmen was kind of a towering figure in the Zen tradition, 9th century, latter half of the 9th century, early 10th century. He was born in a period of just following a lot of political upheaval in China, where there was a lot of disruption and confusion. And it was a period of time when monastics were being sent back to the world. They were being defrocked, secularized. Thousands of monasteries were destroyed. Property was seized. And so he was sort of born into this time, this climate. And as was not unusual, he began training as a young boy. And when he was about 10, there was another great disruption in China, a great rebellion. So again, his life was, his coming of age was taking place within a time of great upheaval. He took the precepts at age 20 and then began studying with a Dharma brother of Master Wang Bo. His teacher's name was Mu Zhao. And he studied with him for a number of years, and then when he was 30, he went to study with another master, Xue Feng, for 17 years. So, seems he was not in a hurry. When he was 55, he was named the abbot of a Lingxiu monastery, and it was a fairly prominent monastery, and so he had to host a lot of visitors coming through, officials and patrons, and he grew tired of all of that. And so at 64, he founded Yunmen Temple on Mount Yunmen, from which he took his name, which was much more remote. And while he was there, on Mount Yunmen, he was called by the emperor to come and visit. And they had a dialogue which really impressed the emperor. And so the emperor said, or decreed that Yunmen would take the office of the inspector of the monks of the capital. And in hearing this, Yunmen was just quiet. And one of the emperor's advisors came up to the emperor and said, this master has completed his training and knows the way. He is not likely to enjoy rising to such a high post. And the emperor turned to Yunmen and said, shall we let you return to your mountain? And Yunmen said, long live the emperor. Long live the emperor. Long live the emperor. There are stories of teachers who have, upon being appointed abbot or some other position, disappear in the night. And it's kind of interesting how, you know, sometimes we get calls from people who, now and then, who call up and say, you know, I'd like to find out what's involved in becoming a Zen master. And so that's usually a pretty short conversation. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, for sincere seekers, you know, that we come to the Dharma not completely free of ambition and, you know, those kinds of notions. But if we're sincere, then we're really coming to study the Dharma. And that certainly being drawn to a monastery, that's usually means there's some affinity and attraction towards solitude and singular devotion to the practice, and then how that can evolve into, you know, responsibilities and positions that might move one away from that, and how people deal with that. When Yunmen was coming close to the end of his life, he was 85 years old, and he began to not eat. He really had no appetite. He wasn't sleeping much. His attendant came up to him one day and offered him a bowl of medicinal broth. And Yunmen took the bowl and then handed it back to him and said, "First, I am fine. Second, you are fine." He didn't need to live forever. So he took care of his personal affairs. Said, "Be sure to write a letter of to request my leave from the emperor, if you don't mind. I will leave." And he said, "After my death, I permit neither the wearing of mourning clothes in conformity with worldly customs, nor wailing and holding a ceremony with a funeral carriage." Remember when Dada Roshi, some of us were at the Abbacy in the months leading up to his death, and he talked about his funeral. And most specifically, he talked about not wanting to have anything to do with it, other than being the being the main event. but we said, "Well, you know, do you have anything to say?" And he said, "Just don't make it too much. Not too much." We did make it a bit much for him, for us, really. Not too much, though. Once Yunmen was asked by a student, "What is Zen?" And Yunmen answered, "Yes." He was well known for very succinct responses, often one word. "What is Zen?" "Yes." The Dharma excludes nothing. It's very simple. It excludes nothing. And of course, it's not a decision that the Dharma makes. The Dharma is not a thing. It's not a consciousness. It's not a force. It's not an entity. It's not anything. And therefore, it excludes nothing. There's nothing apart from it. Exclusion only exists in our mind. The idea of something being excluded, being outside, being apart, being not this, that can only take place in the mind. And it seems that it's only in the realm of the human mind, unique to the human mind. And so all of the teachings that seem to negate not this, not this, not this, not this, is really to help us free ourselves from that exclusioning mind. That mind that excludes, that denies, that avoids, that tries to seek a false escape. And so it's like everything we turn to escape in a way that is not skillful is not helpful. It's like that no meets us and says, no, this is not a path. No, this is not a path. No, this is not a path. When we face a great mountain, it can seem insurmountable from down below. From time immemorial, the mountains have been the dwelling place of the great sages. Wise ones and sages have made the mountains their own chamber, their own body and mind. And through these wise ones and sages, the mountains have been actualized. However many great sages and wise ones we suppose have assembled in the mountains, ever since they entered the mountains, no one has met a single one of them. There is only the actualization of the life of the mountains. Not a single trace of their having entered remains. The countenance of the mountains is completely different when we are in the world gazing off at the mountains and when we are in the mountains meeting the mountains. We could say that all of practice, all of Master Yunmen's yes, is making the mountains your own chamber, your own body and mind. We could say that Zazen is nothing other than this yes. And that this yes is free of yes and no. How is that? It is not yes as opposed to no. It is not yes in the way that we think of yes, but it is not apart from that either. And so Master Yunmen says, I'm not asking about yesterday, I'm not asking about tomorrow. When you block off this entry, when you block off this entry, now, how is it? Yunmen says, every day is a good day. And as I was thinking about this koan, I thought, this might seem like an inappropriate koan for our time, or even a cruel statement. Every day is a good day? Really? Now? In the midst of this? And that's why I wanted to mention that Yunmen had lived through his own time of uncertainty, of disruption, of sickness, of death, of violence. What is this meaning? What is every day is a good day? This is the great challenge of practice. We have to engage the Dharma through language, and the language points the way for us, and it also confuses us at the same time. The commentary says, these words of Yunmen's pervade past and present from before until after and settle everything at once. This pervading means to forget, means to drop away, means all over the body. And so to discover Yunmen's meaning, we have to shake free. In order to really discover every day is a good day, we have to let go of every notion of day, of good, of is. Every day is a good day. Good and bad arise together, but good according to whom? Based on what? Where does good begin? When does it end? Where do you locate it? We base so much of our life on good and bad. Wanting one, wanting, not wanting the other. We start practicing. You know, we're still dripping wet with birth water, right? We haven't even arrived yet. And we sit down and already we know what good Zazen is. Already we know that. Good Zazen, bad Zazen. And so we feel confident in knowing. And so the identity of relative and absolute says, do not judge by any standards. Good is an ever-changing thing, concept, idea. And think about it. I mean, think about what is good and what is it based on, according to our mood, according to our desires. We're famished. We sit down to a meal. This is so good. And then you're full. To continue eating is no longer good. You're the same person, same food. Where is the good in good? And so the great challenge of practice is we have to, in order to truly enter this life and be this life and liberate ourselves, we have to reclaim the mind that doesn't know right and wrong, the mind that doesn't judge good and bad. We have to reclaim the mind that is naturally non-discriminating, naturally, so that we can be free and unburdened in our discernments, in our recognition of what is right and wrong. And not just our recognition, but our entering into right and wrong. We have to let go of pain and suffering and joy and happiness so that we can enter into all of the many worlds and see them as they are. In the poem, when he says, above and below and in the four directions, there is no comparison. This is not a creation of the mind. The mind is the thing, is the function of the mind in our ordinary way of being is constantly creating all of the many ways in which we know and compare and measure and judge. And so in a sense, navigating samsara means becoming more and more of an expert at judging and measuring and comparing, or more and more of a being able to control it or dominate it. But it just doesn't work, ultimately. And so in all four directions, no comparison is not an action of mind. It's not a conscious choice. It's not something we're doing. And because the mind so habitually moves in this way, it takes so much effort and practice to let that constant effort cease, stop, rest. But that too is not enough. It's not enough just to be in a state of rest without seeing. Chinese Master Churi said, stop and see. It's not enough just to stop. We have to see. Every day is a good day. This is really, you know, Master Da Wei said that you should take the great matter of life and death and just put it right here on the end of your nose. It's always there, right? It's never lost. It's always right there in front of you. We might say the same thing about these simple words of Yunmen's. Every day is a good day. I think we could do very well studying those five words for the rest of our lives. I think all of the Buddha Dharma is here. Practice, realization, manifesting, integrating, harmonizing, seeing into heavens and hells, becoming free of heavens and hells, constructing now skillfully our lives within heavens and hells. I think we could take this teaching on us on our way for the long journey. Every day is a good day, but what about the sickness we're in the midst of? What about the confusion, the overwhelm, the anxiety, the loss and grief? Yunmen says, yes. Yes, precisely. When it's most needed, it's most needed. from birth until death. Every day is a good day. Within birth and death, every day is a good day. When I was practicing this morning before I came over, and I was sitting with this koan, I brought this koan, every day is a good day, in my mind, into my body as the body of a doctor in a hospital where the halls are filled with patients, into the rooms overflowing with people needing more than I could offer, being subject to the same illness that they are arrived with. And the nurses. And I took every day as a good day into the body, this body, being in a bed, being the one who had arrived sick. Into the body of the families who were outside that hospital, not able to enter. Into the bodies of those driving the screaming ambulances down the street. What is it now? Every day is a good day. You know the story of the old master who was dying and his students gathered around him as we did around Dadaroshi's deathbed. And he started calling out in pain and groaning, and the students became very uncomfortable with their master calling out this way. And he shook them off and he said, "Don't you understand that my groaning in this way is no different than my laughing?" Not one hair is different and not the same. That's the precipice that practice takes us to. Not one hair is different, and they are not the same. My entering into this body and mind, sitting on my cushion, in a state of peace and tranquility, is not one bit different from my entering into the mind of anxiety and fear of someone visualized, myself visualized in a hospital. The essential nature is not one bit different, and they're not the same. How are they not different? How are they not the same? How is sickness and health and youth and old age and laughing and crying not two? And how are they two? This is Prajnaparamita. This is the double barrier dissolved. And this is really where we ourselves have to challenge ourselves all the way. All the way. Through that double barrier. In other words, into not to, to realize. As Avalokiteshvara, all beings have one essence. In every state, at every time, in every age, in every circumstance, in the midst of every action. When I was meeting with the students last night, somebody asked, how is it? You know, it's one thing to encounter, you know, the sense of good and evil in one's practice, in one's mind, here in the Sendo, in this place, and to bring forth compassion and loving kindness. But how is it when we encounter it directly? Evil. I was reading this morning about people who are establishing, who are scamming the pandemic. Imagine that. Setting up testing sites, taking money to make money. All beings have one essence. And the limits of our confusion and our greed and anger sometimes seem unlimited, unbound. And so I said, you know, we are not inherently good. There is no goodness within us, within a day, within ourselves, that is inherent, that exists by itself, that is like a nugget of goodness somewhere inside of us if we just find it and hold on to it. But we're not inherently bad either. We're not inherently anything at all. That's what the Buddha's enlightenment showed him. That's what all the language and the teachings of the great sky, the boundless ocean, the limitless, is really saying. We're not inherently anything at all. Which in a certain sense that there is means that there is limitless potential within this human form. That is at every moment, and depending on our practice and our understanding, limited. Not just by our vision, but by our entanglements, by our greed and anger and confusion, by our lack of morality, by our lack of empathy. And so, to be most diligent to not spread the virus is recognizing the virus is a real thing. There's nothing inherent in it. It is not a force. It is not a consciousness. It is not an evil. It has its own force. When it comes into contact with humans, it has a most disastrous effect. And this universe holds all of that without conflict. We ourselves can hold all of that with no conflict, as we strive diligently to do all that we can to stop the suffering. And that is a great challenge. Quieting the mind, letting go of thoughts, pacifying turbulent emotions. When we try to make that our liberation, it's really just another attachment. It's another attachment to this, not that. When we're turned around by our thoughts, by our emotions, that's just another attachment. To that, not this. And that's why he says, placidly walking along, he treads down the sound of the flowing stream. His relaxed gaze descries the tracks of the flying birds. The footnote says he's just gone into another nest of entangling vines. A wild fox spirit, as before, is just inside the same old den. We might hear that and think, oh yes, that's it. Placidly walking along. It could be. Relaxed gaze describes the tracks of the flying birds. That could be embracing the whole universe. That could be manifesting in the moment of facing evil. The question is, what's going on in your mind? That's where every day is a good day is realized. As we walk along, that's where it's actualized. And so as the residents were discussing yesterday, that's why practice has to be practiced both in profound solitude, in the quiet and the clarity of your own mind. And in that way, we should never underestimate the power of Zazen, of the profound and unimaginable revolution that is underway. And at the same time, to understand that Zazen is a sitting practice within that deep solitude, essential as it is not enough. It has to be worked out together in good and evil, in right and wrong, within tyrannies, under the rule of despots, under the gaze of blatant delusion that is having profound consequences, when at the same time there's profound kindness and generosity and courage. In the Ecodharma that we've been studying, Joanna Macy talked about these spiritual traps. There are many. She speaks of four. There are many, many ways to get trapped. And that's just important to appreciate. I mean, before we entered the Dharma, there were many ways to get trapped, right? Traps didn't just start when we began practicing. But getting trapped just means getting tangled up in something. In the Dharma, you know, that's why the Buddha spoke so often about the Dharma as a snake. If you want to pick up this snake, you have to know how to pick it up. If we pick it up wrongly, we might very likely get bit. And that's why, because the snake has a lot of power. And so that's why training is so important. That's why teaching is so important. That's why training as students and working with teachers is so important. That's why practicing together is so important. So that we learn how to wield this great power that is within us and around us while creating and falling into as few traps as possible. Which is basically learning how to hold the snake. She said there's the trap of thinking that the phenomenal world is just an illusion. The three worlds are mind. How many times has the analogy of a magician been used since antiquity? It is an illusion. But in the very sense that it is an illusion, so is practice and liberation. The question is, how are we using the illusion? We can dream a nightmare. We can dream a community that takes care of each other and that covers the whole earth. It being an illusion is not a problem. The basis of the illusion, how we use the illusion, not knowing it's an illusion, is where it becomes a trap. She says suffering, we can believe that suffering is a mistake, that if we're suffering, some of that was brought up yesterday in our discussion, that if we're suffering, that means because we're doing something wrong. That having an attachment is sort of like a personal crime or sin. Rather than recognizing it's the natural result of our minds that have been conditioned to work in the ways that every single human mind has been conditioned to work. That's why Buddhism doesn't talk about it in those terms. It doesn't frame it in those terms. And so within our attachments, within our suffering, those are just the results, the logical results, really, of all that has come before within our world, within ourselves. And the fact that it's coming forth in this moment means that it's showing us, it's giving us the opportunity to create a revolution. Having gone this way before, the fruits of that path have arisen. Okay, let's go another way. Just know the trap is that we create our world unilaterally by the power of our mind. The Yogacara school is sometimes misunderstood this way. Mind only, the three worlds are mind. Like, none of this exists, you're just making it up. And so if you walk into a wall or you crash your car into somebody else's, that's not really happening. Right? Of course that's foolishness. And yet in our own private ways, we can grab onto such a notion and think that all of what's happening in the world isn't real, so really we don't need to worry about it. I wonder how that'll go when that person themselves gets sick. And the corollary, she says, is the world is already perfect if we just view it the right way. The great way is perfect, like vast space. No lack and no excess. So if we're just peaceful, then the world will be peaceful. The fact that it doesn't appear peaceful, that's your delusion. And that's why intention is so important. Like if we really want to free ourselves and if we really want other people to be free, then none of those traps are going to satisfy us for very long at all. We're going to realize it's bullshit. We're being fooled, we're fooling ourselves. That can't be true, that view. I do not accept that. Or we might think that the Dharma is somehow inherently imperfect because we can get trapped. That if it was really true, we wouldn't be able to get trapped, right? That as a practitioner, you would always do the right thing. That's just not understanding Dharma, ourselves, the world, karma. I was thinking about this in terms of the Buddha's, by his own words, saying that after his enlightenment, he considered not teaching. You know, and he says that he realized, you know, this Dharma is so profound and subtle, it can't be grasped with the senses. People in the world just have too much dust in their eyes. But I wondered if he was also thinking in that moment, having realized this, the depths, the profound nature of what he had realized was enlightened to, and all of its implications and ramifications, if he was hesitant because he realized this which is could be the great medicine, if not used well, and it will not always be used well, could do harm. If he paused in the awareness of that possibility. I don't know. It's sort of like, you know, when we're young and we think about doing something, you know, our vision is more limited because we haven't had much experience, and so we tend to just jump into things, right? And sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes it's not so good. And as we get older, we have more experience, we have the capacity to see more beyond that action, have a sense more of what the consequences might be, which sometimes is too a good thing, sometimes not so good. The old master said, just don't see that there are any Buddhas above, don't see there are any sentient beings below, don't see that there are mountains and rivers and earth without, and don't see that there are seeing, hearing, discernment, or knowledge within. Then you will be like one who has died the great death and returned to life. Now, with long and short, good and evil, all fused into one whole, though you bring them up one by one, you'll no longer see them as different. After that, you'll be able to function responsively without losing your balance. And that's why he says in the poem, he throws away one and picks up seven. He throws away shunyata and picks up the whole world. And I think it's just this matter that when all the dualities have fused into one and we no longer see them as different, and then we enter in every moment the world and are challenged, are humbled, are stopped by something new or by something old. And in that moment, we realize that that which we've realized as one has become two again. That which is fused and is undivided by its very nature, we have in our mind again divided. And so the faith mind says, when doubts arise, remember not to. And so the practice is continually entering back into that. He says, then the myriad forms and multitude of appearances, plants, animals, people, disasters, heartbreaks, fears, everything, everywhere completely manifests the way of your own house. Every day is a good day. Every day is a good day, and every day is different. And those, that is what is fused into one undivided whole. Many people pursue the branches and don't seek the root. First, get the root right. Then naturally, when the wind blows, the grass bends down. Naturally, where water flows, a stream forms. You know, I've thought so many times about how, you know, I think so many of us, when we come into practice, I know I did. I mean, I knew it was going to be difficult. I knew it was going to be a challenge. I knew it wasn't going to be fast. Kind of I knew that. But I had no idea. How could I? And that the difficulties I imagined and the length of time and all the challenges, I imagined them in a way that was very manageable. So in every way that I thought, yeah, this is going to be hard and this is going to be challenging, it was all fairly neatly put together so I could hold it and think, yeah, okay, I'm up for that. I had no idea. And I think that's probably just a very good thing, that we can have no idea. You know, it's sort of like, you know, if you just came out of the womb and suddenly had omniscience and could see the whole of your life, would you keep going forward or you crawl back in? And the reason I think it's good not to know is because we would be knowing, in a sense, from a place where we're not ready to know. We have enough capacity to have entered and crossed the threshold. And that whatever we meet in that moment, we have enough to meet that moment. Right? Just like when we're born, we have enough capacity to start screaming and go about the business of getting fed and being held. And then day by day, we move into it, step into it. From the very beginning, we're that person. We have been born. We didn't get born halfway. We got born the whole way. But we haven't fully stepped into it yet. We're not ready. We're ready for... We're ready for crying and being fed. This every day is a good day, beyond good and evil, so that we can hold good and evil while holding the cries of the world, our grief and our sorrow, and our recognition that we are here on this beautiful morning and other people are sitting in a very different world and a very different morning, and it's the same, and it's not the same. And how can that be? How do we reconcile that? Is it about reconciliation? Is there something deeper? Yes. This is what all of the teachers have been pointing to. This is what the Buddha realized. He says at the end of the poem, don't make a move if you move 30 blows. And so when we encounter that which we want to run away from, in the session I had last night, one of the students said that in her work, she faces some very, very difficult challenges. And sometimes she wants to run away. And I said, yeah, I know. I know. I said, but how about this? When it really gets bad, run away for a minute in your mind. And then come back. There's space enough in your mind to run away for a moment or two. But we have to come back. And I said, and you already know that. And she nodded. We do already know that. Human once said, again to at another time, I don't want to be told about before or after today. Come on, tell me something about today. And then on behalf of the Sangha, he said, now's the time. You see, then too, it was true. So I'll end with a poem. Quiet Sunday morning, pierced with the siren's sound, a calling out, a crying out into the open sky. Go ahead, bring your fear and trepidation into this dark night, into this bright, bright light. Every day is a good day. It is so vast because of this. Here, now, we can each find our way to the great need. Because of this, we can find our way. Last night also several people spoke about being called through their work or through their various circumstances to step forward in ways that they just didn't feel prepared to do. I said, yeah, that's what happens. I mean, in a much, much different way. It's like in the beginning of our time here when Dada Roshi was here and there were only a few of us. Everybody was being asked to step forward in ways that we weren't prepared for. Because there was a need. And this was who was there. And that's what happens. And so we step forward with what we've got. And we do the best we can. And in that way, we succeed, not at getting what we want, not fulfilling our expectations, but in, yes. We succeed in yes. And that is not a small thing. And so I do encourage each of us to really consider these words of Master Yuman. Every day is a good day. I remember when I first encountered this koan years ago and I thought, I had the sense that I would take this with me for the rest of my life.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.